Welcome back to the Bob Davis Podcasts. In podcast 703, we're going to talk about something that I've been wanting to talk about this for a while, and it's an appropriate time to talk about it. We're going to talk about differences in America, regional differences and differences within states. When it comes to people, the things we think about, the things we believe in, and our heritage, let's say, we'll talk about that in podcast 703. Well, it doesn't feel like it right now, but spring is coming. In fact, wherever I go lately, people are like, well, it's getting light. You know, it's pretty cool to see the sun shining at, 7 o'clock in the morning these days. And it's pretty fun to see the blue skies and the sun coming up at 6:30, 5:30, 6:45 if you get up early. Because you know that spring is coming, and you know that that bike sitting in your garage is going to get back out on the road. This is the time to think about products and accessories for your motorcycle that make it badass, make it sound badass, and make it safe. And this is where Ciro3D.com comes in. This is the great motorcycle products and accessories company. They have great safety options, lighting for the front and back, as well as device mounts and foot pegs and pipes and all kinds of stuff that make the bike just super cool to ride. So check out Ciro3D.com. Click on the banner at the top of the page, thebobdavispodcast.com, or just go to Ciro3D.com. Ride safe and happy spring when it finally comes. Although, I kind of think that we're going to be thinking it's going to come, but it's not going to come as fast as we think it's going to come. But there's that. Thanks for listening to the Bob Davis Podcasts on all these different devices. Of course, I always talk about right off the page at thebobdavispodcast.com. We have streaming audio. And depending on your phone, certain devices work better with certain apps. Stitcher.com, TuneIn, iTunes, of course, for your iPhone. I see a lot of iOS, whether it's for the pad or for the phone, and those types of listening systems for listening to podcasts. And for some of you, I really do recommend apps like Podbean, Podcatcher. There's a bunch of other ones. I don't have them all, but I see them on the analytics. So thanks for listening and liking and sharing and favoriting and following on Facebook and Twitter. Appreciate the donations for the Bob Davis Podcasts at thebobdavispodcast.com. Sometimes they are the difference between keeping the lights on and not. So for all of you who have donated, Kelly and others, I really, really appreciate it. It makes a big difference for me. Well, this podcast was triggered by a friend. Recently, we were out, and they said, why is Minnesota so liberal? So this is a person that identifies as a quote-unquote conservative. And don't worry about that. I'm going to come back to that question later. But first, when it comes to differences, specifically political differences in the United States, a word about words. The words liberal and conservative are two of the most overused political terms, probably in U.S. history and certainly in the present time frame. They are increasingly used to divide us. They are increasingly partisan and thus increasingly meaningless. For example, is a Republican who advocates for government money to be spent on infrastructure or stadiums for sports team owners a conservative? What about a Democrat who supports the Second Amendment? Is he a liberal? What about when it comes to spending money for things like education? Is a Republican in the state legislature who consistently votes to increase spending for, the state parks and education a conservative? What about a pro-choice Republican? Is a pro-choice Republican a conservative? Or for that matter, an anti-abortion Democrat? So I'm going to avoid terms like conservative and liberal and left. They're actually descriptive in this podcast, because what I want to talk about are regional and local differences in the United States, and I guess secondarily their effects on the political process, because we're coming up, and I'm going to talk about this as well. We're coming up on an election cycle, and there's going to be an awful lot of discussion, regardless of what media we consume, that there's this bird's eye view of the United States, that it's national and we're Americans and we're a monolith. Being an American means that we eat the same kinds of foods, we listen to the same kind of music, we dress the same, look the same, and all that, right? Well, of course, you're going to say, no, that's not true. That's the picture, though, that's being presented to us through the national media. We think things are the same in Rapid City, or at least we're told that things are the same in Rapid City as they are in Minneapolis, as they are in Oxnard, California. But yet we know that that's not true. Even if there are differences when it comes to where we live, we are told, and I'm not trying to blame the media. I'm just saying this is how people who write about politics tend to make sense of things, because if you can define everything as one thing, then it's easier to say this is different or this is the same or this is what the election's about. So this isn't, you know, a rant about fake news or anything else, which is, by the way, becoming pretty passe as well. It's the idea that we're all pretty much the same. And from, you know, 25,000 feet up, perhaps we are. If you look at ratings, if you look at all that kinds of stuff, the national statistics, it looks like we watch the same things on TV. Our local shopping centers are full of these national chains, whether it's furniture stores or taco shops. We buy things from Amazon. We search for things on Google and so on. Now, I've traveled across the country a lot, and I love talking about differences, and I love talking about travel, because travel really shows you the differences. I can remember going to Florida with my parents. I've often talked about this. Now, I'm from a big city. I'm from Chicago. So we were used to I lived in the South Side, and I remember that springtime to me smelled like sulfur, because the wind from the Gary U.S. Steelworks would kind of drift over the South Side and in the spring, and that springtime smelled like sulfur, which was what it smells like when they make steel. And it's funny, because when I lived in Pittsburgh, I lived close to one of the mills, and I remember smelling that, and I thought, oh my God, I'm home, right? So we would drive south through the Appalachia, you know, mountains all the way down to Florida. And at that time, a lot of the South was very undeveloped or underdeveloped and poor. And so you could really, there was a marked difference from when you were in Chicago, when you went through Georgia, a marked difference from when you were in Rolla, Missouri versus Chicago. So regionally, it's one of the first experiences I had traveling as a kid, was the difference geographically, the differences in people, the differences in the way things appeared from the window of a car. In my case, the back seat or the way back of the 63, you know, Chevy Biscayne, and later their used electric convertible. So it's somewhat surprising that those differences still exist, but it is true that regions and states have significant differences, and people in these different regions actually do look different and they act different. For instance, you don't see too many Western shirts and straw cowboy hats in Michigan or New Hampshire, or really even in parts of Minneapolis and St. Paul where I live. You have to go out to Texas and Kansas and Oklahoma and way out in western Minnesota in the summer to see those kinds of hats. Even in individual states, things are different within those states, because different regions, different parts of the states have different histories. And the other thing I think is interesting, and if you've traveled, you're following along with this podcast, probably thinking the same thing. I was shocked at physically how large, geographically speaking, these states are. Certainly the western states like Montana and Nebraska and some of the states in the Mid-South like Tennessee, especially if you're going through the long way, are huge. All the states are big. And you don't think the states out east are that big, but I'll take the smallest state, which is Rhode Island, which I always thought, well, I was out in Rhode Island one time and my friends were like, we're going to go from Providence, we're going to go down to the beaches and check them out. And so you can see the little New England towns that are down here along the Atlantic coast. And I thought, well, this will take 10 minutes because Rhode Island is so small. Well, I found out that Rhode Island, small as it is, it takes quite some time to travel up and down those coastal towns in Rhode Island. And this is true. Also, you know, New York and New Jersey and Maine, you think are big states. You think New York and New Jersey are... When I think of New Jersey, I think of on the waterfront, or I think of Hoboken. I think of, very urban parts of New Jersey. In New York, obviously, we all think of New York City. But in fact, New York and New Jersey are big agricultural states. And New Jersey, there are parts of New Jersey when you go along the coast in the summer and you would think that you were in Florida. Some of the most spectacular beaches, if not the most spectacular Atlantic beaches in the country are, in fact, in New Jersey. And it would shock you to know that. But if you travel the state, you'll find out it's a pretty big damn state. And, of course, in those states which are associated with big cities like New York City, there's a lot of farming. Why do you think they call it the Garden State? And a lot of rural landscape in New York. New York is a massive state. The New York Thruway is just amazing. It's like being in West Virginia. So the personality of these states depends on who settled them and when and how they developed. And so the politics of each state depends on the political history of the state and the political history of the people who live there. When it became a state, who settled it, where did they come from, considering that we're all immigrants, you know, what's their history? And it all depends on how mobile the people who live there are. You know, I lived in Pittsburgh for a while, and one of the things we had to do at the radio station was we used to have to go to these little, regional councils and talk to people as something that was required by the FCC at the time called ascertainment. And this was to ascertain the needs of the community. And I loved ascertainment because you had to go to school board meetings and stuff like that and actually interview people. And one of the things I learned about Pittsburgh was that, Pittsburgh is one of the places in the United States where urban renewal began before any other part of the country. Urban renewal, such as it is as we know it today, began in Pittsburgh in the early 30s because all of the mills were down at what's called the Point. And now the Point is this beautiful park, and it's just this amazing, beautiful downtown area. You come out of the tunnel there, the Allegheny Tunnel, and the city just explodes in your face. It's beautiful, Pittsburgh. And at the time, Pittsburgh was, very choked in industry. In fact, a lot of times you would think it was night when you were in Pittsburgh and it was day, and men who worked in the buildings in downtown often took two or three shirts with them because by the time the day ended, their shirts would be covered with all kinds of dust and pollution from those plants in downtown Pittsburgh. So they started moving them upriver and downriver in the 1930s and cleaning it up. And obviously, when I got there, most of the steel industry had moved to the south where right-to-work laws were in place, and they'd moved a lot of the plants to other parts of the United States. The steel industry is still going strong. It's just that it's not all in Pittsburgh. And there were all these unemployed people in Pittsburgh, and it was a big political issue. And I remember talking to this woman who said, here's the thing. We can get these people jobs at steel mills in Georgia and Tennessee and Alabama and, Mississippi, where they've moved much of the steel industry, but they won't move. And so these people all live, and they lived right in Pittsburgh in these little row houses that were up in the hills. The other thing that's really cool, there's a movie called Into the Fire, I think it's called. And it's a movie, it doesn't matter, it's a drama about a guy who gets out of jail and he's trying to help his brother and on and on and on. When you watch this movie, you would think that these people lived in West Virginia someplace. But in fact, that town where that story is set is actually in Pittsburgh proper. And it looks like a backwoods New Jersey town. But that's, you go over a hill and you could be in New Jersey, in Pittsburgh. It's just an interesting, takeaway from just moving and living in different places and getting to know people, In Minnesota, and it's true as well in Pittsburgh, and the point of the story about Pittsburgh was to tell you that these people wouldn't move because Pittsburgh was their home. Pittsburgh, as they say, was their home. Minnesota, it's the same thing, where you have people who have from two or three generations that live in towns, whether it's, Minneapolis and St. Paul, really not often the major city, but, little towns around the cities. St. Bonifacius or something. So three or four generations of the family have lived there, and you meet those people and you say, hey, where do you work? And they say, oh, I work in the city, or I work over in Edina or whatever. And then you say, well, why don't you move to Edina near where you work so you don't have to drive as far when you go back to St. Bonnie or whatever, wherever they live. And they go, oh, that's ridiculous. I wouldn't do that. My grandmother lives there. My mom lives there. My brother lives there. So Minnesota doesn't have a lot of mobility in and out of the state. So the people who live here go back three and four and five generations. And a lot of the people who live in the city go back two generations from the farm, whether it's Wisconsin or Minnesota, and to a slightly lesser extent, North and South Dakota. And it has an effect on the politics and the society of the state. So when a state became a state, the people that live in the state, the story of the state, all those things have a lot to do with the politics of the state. And then there's this question of mobility. Now, that is not necessarily true in places like California, Nevada, and Arizona, and Florida, where people consistently move there. But I found out that Arizona is interesting because most Midwesterners move to Arizona when they want to move to a warmer climate. So there's a lot of people from Detroit and Chicago and Minneapolis and St. Paul and now North and South Dakota and so forth down in Phoenix and Tucson. And then most of the people from the East Coast move to Florida. So when you go to Florida, you run into a lot of people from Jersey and from Pittsburgh and from Cherry Hill, New Jersey, and from New York State and so forth. To the extent that I remember when I worked there, I met this girl who talked like she's from New Jersey. You know, she would always say things like, you know, so I told her, you know, we can't. And she had the whole thing, the big hair, the nails, and the whole East Coast, New Jersey kind of look. And I remember asking the woman I worked for, well, she must be, where is she from? She must be from New Jersey. And she was like, oh, no, she's a Florida native. She grew up here. But that's the way she talked. Now, when I was a kid and we used to go to Florida, there were actually real Floridians, you know, people. And they had a way of talking. They would say, instead of saying hi, they would say hey. And you said hey to the real Floridians. Today, Florida is like New Jersey with palm trees, right? But then Florida is interesting because the middle part of the state and the south middle part of the state has a different history and different approach and different attitude than either coast. The west coast of Florida is different from the east coast of Florida, and the panhandle is different from both the east coast, the central, and the west coast of Florida. So this idea that we are this monolithic culture really doesn't work. And every state is like that. There are stories when you get into it and you start pulling down the layers, you start realizing how different all these states are and within regions within those states. And I just think it's really important to point that out when we're being told the issue in this election, because it's the easy way to report on it is fill in the blank. Most of the time, it's a local thing and it's local people, and local people are liked and disliked for various reasons. So it's really important to point that out in preparation for 2018 election coverage and just for fun. One thing about traveling is you learn that spring comes to certain parts of the country before other parts of the country. And if you live in Minnesota, you know that winters, I mentioned earlier that we feel like it's going to be spring soon, but you know, it'll be spring on March 21st, technically, but we can have really bad snow and cold all the way through to May. And sometimes the second part of winter, which is in the spring, is the worst part of winter, and that wreaks havoc with your systems, whether it's water heaters, furnaces, and pipes. This can create all kinds of problems. And as I've mentioned in a bunch of different commercials I've done for Ryan Plumbing and Heating of St. Paul, this is why we call plumbers. One of the things I hear a lot is, well, I went and fixed it myself and I did this. No, I gave myself a haircut the other day. I didn't feel that I needed a professional to shave my head, but when it comes to plumbing and heating or running these different systems, I got to have somebody that knows what they're doing, and this is what we mean by reliable service. That means Ryan Plumbing and Heating. Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul, you can call 651-224-4771 in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. They go back four generations in St. Paul's Frogtown, quality replacement and repair of all plumbing, heating, and air conditioning systems, residential and business. Got to mention, if you are a journeyman plumber, Ryan is hiring because they're so busy that they need your help. So if you're looking for work, use those same numbers to reach Ryan. 651-224-4771 in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. If you're the plumber looking for a gig, ask for Greg Ryan at Ryan Plumbing and Heating of St. Paul. So let's talk about politics and return to the question, why is Minnesota so liberal? This, I hear this all the time from people in very, you know, I never hear it from someone who's a Democrat. I never hear my Democrat friend say, why is Minnesota so liberal? I hear other things from them, and that's a different podcast, but from the Minnesota, supposedly Minnesota conservative, you'll often hear them say, why is this state so damn liberal? Well, Minnesota really isn't liberal, actually. Minnesota is socially conservative in the sense that people in this state are more reserved than a place like Chicago or Baltimore. They are not as quick to tell you what they think. Oddly enough, when I was in Ohio, I went, as you guys know, if you listen to the podcast, I went to my grandfather's hometown and people there wouldn't talk to me. And I talked to my mom and she said, oh yeah, they're pretty closed mouth up there. You know, now she is from Ohio and she's from Columbus, Ohio. So she's a city girl from Columbus. This is way up in the rural part in the mountainous sort of West Virginia. It's just north of Parkersburg, West Virginia in south central Ohio. And they knew about that part of the state, but she always referred to them as being very closed mouth. Well, Minnesota is like that all over the place. People from Minnesota are not as likely to share with you. They're very nice. They'll be nice to you, but you know, Minnesotans don't automatically start telling everyone their life story. Minnesota has a higher concentration of people from Norway and Sweden and Germany who came here when those regions of the world were in upheaval. Now, you add that to a little bit smaller concentration of Irish and other European ethnicities who came to the U.S. during times of upheaval in Ireland or Germany. Now, in the lower part of the state, most of the people that came here were from Germany and from Sweden and Norway, and then the other immigrants would have been Irish. To work on the railroad or to work for 3M or one of the industrial sections or to farm. In the northern part of the state, there were a lot of people from Hungary and Czechoslovakia and places like that who came to work in the taconite mines. And I found out an interesting fact when I was traveling. So obviously, when you get into the northern tier of the United States, way up north by the Canadian border, you know, you've got these taconite reserves. So Minnesota has taconite mines, and then going over across northern Wisconsin, then you get into Wisconsin, which I didn't. I'm sorry, not Wisconsin, but Michigan. The Upper Peninsula of Michigan also has taconite, and I did not know that the taconite miners in Upper Michigan are Welsh, and my family's Welsh. My family came to the U.S. to work in the coal mines in West Virginia and Central Ohio. So it's just interesting how you had one group be taconite miners and one group be coal miners. So we have a mining contingent in the northern part of the state, and more ethnic, they are more ethnic. But the thing that I think is unique about these immigrants and the time that they came to Minnesota, and I hope I'm not offending academics because this is really, I have to do this quick because I'm not going to sit here and do an hour-long podcast about this, but it's fascinating to me. They came here during the 1840s, 1850s, 1860s, 1870s, when Sweden and Norway and Germany were undergoing these upheavals, partially as a result of the Industrial Revolution. And at that time, socialism was very popular in those parts of the world. And there's also even deeper ideas about being your brother's keeper in places like Norway and Sweden. I mean, this is, after all, the birth of Lutheranism. So those people brought that with them. And because Minnesota is not as mobile as other states, that has been handed down generation to generation. So you've got that going. The other thing is Minnesota politically is probably more susceptible to populism, which some define as supporting the little guy, the farmer laborer against the so-called elites, because the populist political party goes back to this battle between the farmers who needed a different economic system and a different system of banking than the industrial East. So you had the farmers arrayed against the railroad interests and the industrial interests. And Minnesota is right smack dab in the middle of all of that. So there's a populist tendency in this state politically to be for the little guy. And this goes back, as I said, to the days when farmers battled railroad interests in the state. And it had to do with banking, I think, more importantly than anything else. Republicans in Minnesota have always been stronger in the rural areas of the state, while Democrats stronger in the Twin Cities, in Olmsted County, and on the so-called range where the miners lived, and of course they were unionized. You know, I grew up in Illinois where unions were strong across the state. And by the way, Illinois is a largely rural and agricultural state with a huge industrial and business center in Chicago and a little bit smaller industrial area. areas in the central and western central part of the state, like, for example, the Illinois part of the Quad Cities. Part of southern Illinois may be as well, viewed as Kentucky. Parts of northern and southern Illinois are very conservative, but the south and central and northern part of the state has always been outvoted and dominated by the machine politics in Cook County, dominated and controlled by Chicago, a very highly ethnicized area. Chicago, a city of neighborhoods, Cook County, a city of neighborhoods, where you have Latino and Italian and, Eastern European, and we're talking about Ukrainians and Czechs and all these people that came to work in the mills. And then after World War I, a lot of Southern people, not just Black people from the South, but also Southerners, to the extent that there's a part of Chicago on the north side, which was considered a southern neighborhood. And this was people who moved from Tennessee and Kentucky and places like that to work in the mills, moved to this one little part of Chicago, whereas Black people pretty much concentrated on the south side. So you've got this just cauldron of different ethnicities and people. Chicago had a huge problem with anarchists and unionists in the early part of the 20th century and the late part of the 19th century. And as I've often mentioned, the most famous mayor of the city of Chicago, even over Daley, was a guy named Carter Harrison, who would go up to the German part of town and ride a white horse and would go to Oktoberfest. And he could always bring in the vote on election day, because Oktoberfest is in October, elections in November. And Carter Harrison would ride his white horse up to the German neighborhoods, and they'd vote for him in mass. And of course, Harrison Station on the Red Line for the CTA is, I thought it was named after President Harrison. In fact, it's named after Carter Harrison, still the longest serving, I believe, mayor of Chicago in history. I don't know if Daley's son outlived those times, but Carter Harrison still is probably one of the clearly the most popular mayor of the city of Chicago. So you see, these differences are just huge. And San Francisco is an equally large city. It developed later than Chicago. I've often called it Chicago with hills, but San Francisco has a huge contingent of Chinese who have been there since before California was a state. So these are and not just that, but people from Mexico and so forth who have been there since before California was a state. So when you get into these individual states, California is actually a conservative state, but it's dominated by Democrats. And many of those Democrats, pretty conservative in themselves in Cook County. Every single state has a story like that. Central Florida, as I've mentioned, it's often talked about how the eastern South Dakotans are more, rock-ribbed Republican moderates, while western South Dakota tend to be more Mountain West and libertarian, and so forth. Most people think California, as I mentioned, is a liberal state, but my understanding is that south of Los Angeles, Orange County, all the way down to San Diego, it's home to some pretty solid Republican districts. And of course, Richard Nixon was from Whittier, California, which now is a suburb of Los Angeles. And of course, Ronald Reagan was an Illinois native who became governor of the Golden State. And there have been Republican governors since Ronald Reagan, and there will be Republican governors again in California. People talk about California, Minnesota, as being super liberal. You kind of have to understand it. I mean, my travels in California, the eastern and rural part of California is probably more like the Mountain West than the coast. And then you get into these very interesting liberal influences in northern and southern California, which would not be foreign to people from northern Minnesota, who are environmentally oriented. So you have, I have a friend who is from a mining family in northern Minnesota, and she is super liberal. She's a socialist. And she just hates Trump and everything else. And she's all about the environment. Her brother is a miner, super conservative, super Republican, loves Trump. And it's just fascinating that you have this division in the same family, and they're both from the same part of the country. When I travel, I'm always struck by the differences, which can be very subtle state to state, how people talk, the different regional chains and stores. And by the way, there are academics that have spent their careers, categorizing the accents from different parts of the country. When I was growing up, I can't really do it anymore, but when I was growing up, I could tell by the way you talked if you were from northern the part northern, north side of Chicago, the west side of Chicago, or the south side of Chicago. We all talked a certain way. And I could even tell you almost which neighborhood you were from by the way that you sounded and the way that you talked. So this regional and local difference is pretty pronounced most of the time. Then you have all these different regional chains and stores and grocery stores, you know, some of which have become national, some of which haven't, and by the different politics and the issues that drive those politics in these places. And of course, you know, there's a lot of these social theory books that say that the United States is really nine nations or really 11 nations, and that we cobbled together this nation from these 11 different nations. So let's talk politics a little bit here. We're just at the beginning of what many political junkies call an off-year cycle. This means that the president is not running for re-election. That's every 4 years. But arguably, the most important position is open every 2 years, and that's that of congressman. The only federal office the people voted for was Congress up until the 17th Amendment was ratified in 1913. We don't directly elect U.S. presidents, as you know. So really, we should refer to the presidential election as an off-year election, since every 2 years, we're electing a completely new Congress, a Congress that has more power than any president to wreak havoc on the population, including electing one-third of the U.S. Senate since 1913. This cycle also features statewide races for one Senate seat, obviously, governorships, state house representatives in most states, and various special elections. Minnesota is electing two senators because of the resignation of Senator Al Franken, a governor. We're electing the state legislature and various other state positions. And as I said earlier, the media tries to nationalize the congressional election cycle. I don't think it's an agenda. I think it's because it makes it easier for them to talk about the elections. It also enables them to say things are this way, except here's an analyst to tell us how things in this district are different from the rest of it. So they've got sort of an objective reality that they can work from. That is in fact not the objective reality, because whether it's guns or spending or war or whatever is on the front burner on the national level, nothing is more hyper-local in America than the congressional district. Even with gerrymandering, and maybe because of gerrymandering, congressional districts can be very quirky. By the way, gerrymander comes from Elbridge Gerry, a founding father, the fifth vice president of the U.S. and the governor of Massachusetts, who signed a bill that created the first curiously misshapen district in the state, in any state, and this is in Massachusetts. And it was designed to elect Democratic Republicans over Federalists in 1812. This is how you get these weird horseshoe and strangely misshapen districts like you see a lot of in Maryland and South Carolina, which have the highest numbers of the so-called worst gerrymandered districts. Oddly enough, 8 out of 10 of those worst districts were drawn by Republicans, but 10 of the 10 worst gerrymandered districts, 9 of them are consistently won by Democrats. They draw districts by usually a bipartisan council, which is chosen by the majority. So that can have a lot to do with whether Republican districts are gerrymandered versus Democrat districts. Most of the time, congressional wins and losses are driven by local issues. For instance, in the 8th District in northern Minnesota, mining interests, environmental interests are really key, but so are, you know, Second Amendment issues and pro-union issues. So it's kind of a weird mix, whereas in the 1st District, it has to do with farming and it has to do with the Mayo Clinic and, you know, Rochester and places like that. Illinois' 12th district generally elects Republicans, while the 1st and 2nd districts, Chicago, basically, are some of the strongest Democrat districts in the U.S. Finally, while ersatz social sciences, science books like The Fourth Turning or these 9 and 11 Nations of North America books ignore a very real, unique quality of individual states and individual counties and congressional districts, which is our own unique history. But we're not like the EU, for example, which attempts to knit together 13 or 14 countries with completely different political and social histories to fulfill a very real European dream of a single continental government. The United States Constitution was ratified in 1790, and when they ratified the U.S. Constitution, most of what is today the U.S. was populated by Native Americans. There were no governments or law aside from tribal law, which governed Indians for the most part, or didn't. in what would become the United States. Article 1 of the U.S. Constitution includes a provision which leaves conduct and supervision of the elections to state legislatures. The only requirements constitutionally is that the state governments have the same type of system of countervailing, wings of the government as the federal government. So we have an executive legislature and courts in all 50 states. But all 50 states have regional and legal differences when it comes to state constitutions, how elections are to be conducted, and how the state is to be organized. In some states, the county Democrat or Republican chair is extremely important. Other places, he or she isn't. Minnesota has a weird, quirky thing with the basic political units based on Senate districts. There is uniformity in the type of government that we have. In that key respect, the United States wasn't 11 nations settled separately. So that's kind of nonsensical, even though you can look at social trends and say it's different here than it was there. And of course, this is going to continue. 100 years from now, we'll be referring to this time as times when significant things happened in states that made them different, let's say. But in most places where no government existed, first there was a territorial government based on the U.S. government. Then when the territory became a state government was created in the image of the federal government. This is the uniform. But as one who has traveled, the lower 48 states are each unique, which makes the United States very interesting from a social and political perspective because we have similar governments, but we are very, very different state to state. So why don't certain things get done when people in another part of the country are convinced that the time has come for such and such a thing? It doesn't matter which end of the political spectrum you hail from. Some things just don't happen because parts of states and regions simply do not agree. And it is not always what you expect, considering, for example, what is raging now as I speak, aside from a snowstorm outside, the gun debate. Many supporters of gun bans or whatever are just shocked that they can't seem to get states to change their gun laws and would be quite surprised to find a number of so-called liberal representatives and governors and state representatives and senators who would never vote for such a thing in a place like West Virginia that is really, a long-term Democrat state, although there's another state that's got a lot of Republicans, but it seems to be sort of moving back in the other direction. But West Virginia is one of those states where gun control, doesn't fly very well because of the strong opinions of people in various parts and counties and places in West Virginia, for example. Again, the northern and rural parts of Minnesota, considered liberal by some, are generally against any revisions in the Second Amendment because they're hunters or because they like guns. And while they wouldn't even consider legalizing marijuana in Minnesota, parts of the state of Washington and Colorado, as you know, already have. To the original question, actually, Colorado already has as a state. So to the original question, Minnesotans tend to the middle on most political questions, and even the so-called conservative support spending for more education, mass transit, and so-called public commons projects. Minnesotans privately say things, but publicly they tend to be reticent to get into arguments. They tend to be a little passive-aggressive along those lines, whereas people in Baltimore will just throw down and start fighting over anything. But Minnesotans are socially conservative and even religious, including Democrats. Depending on the issue and depending on the personal issue. Minnesotans who are libertarian, Minnesotans who are alt-right, of course not equating the two, Minnesotans who consider themselves to be moderate Republicans. To win a statewide race in Minnesota as a Republican, the Republican has to be perceived as religiously and even fiscally conservative, but they also have to support education, public commons sorts of arguments, and be for the little guy. And yeah, it's an impossible situation, especially when you deal with dominated counties like Hennepin and Ramsey and Minneapolis and St. Paul, St. Louis County up in the northern part of the state, or Olmsted County, which have, in a similarity to Chicago, taken a relatively conservative, relatively moderate Republican state and turned it into a Democrat state because of the concentration of people, because most of the people in the state actually live in the Minneapolis and St. Paul area. So those are some differences. And when you hear people talking about things going on, it's important to remember, this country has vastly different places with vastly different ideas about things, even though there is a certain degree of uniformity and similarity. And that's why it's so important to travel. Well, in some parts of the country, another one of the big issues is, of course, foreign manufacturing. Some places are, you know, not as concerned about it as other places. It's a national issue because President Trump is a trade protectionist. And this means if you are in a company that is considering reshoring to the United States manufacturing, then you want to think about Depot Star, American design, engineering, and manufacturing right here in Minnesota. Visit their website at depotstar.com, D-E-P-O-T, Depot Star. And again, don't forget Ryan Plumbing and Heating of St. Paul to keep all those systems operating when they're expanding and contracting. When it gets cold, then it gets warm and it rains and it snows. Welcome to late winter, early spring in Minnesota. Remember, you want reliable service. Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul, 651-224-4771. In Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. Online at ryanplumbing.com. Again, if you're a plumber, they need plumbers. They're busy, busy, busy right now because Ryan is great. So you can contact them at the same numbers if you're a journeyman plumber. And thanks, Ryan, for sponsoring the Bob Davis podcast. Okay, I'm done. I'm going to finish my coffee and think about travel and all the wonderful places I can go. I definitely got some plans for that coming, you know, looking forward here into early spring. So hopefully I'll be talking about that soon. Thanks for listening to Podcast 703, the Bob Davis Podcast, Differences in America. It's all good.